The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your biweekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined this week by Evan Burnick of IJ's Center for Judicial Engagement, as well as special guest, Paul Mr. Congeniality Sherman. This week on the show, free speech on campus, free speech off campus, and free speech near a courthouse, as well as prevailing wages for private projects. Paul, let's start things off in the Ninth Circuit.
This case is called O'Brien v. Welty, and it's an interesting look at some of the First Amendment issues that are happening on public college campuses now, which, as our listeners probably know, is a very hot issue. It's going on all across the country. It involves a young man named Neil O'Brien, who's pursuing a degree in recreation at Fresno State. And he's also something of a James O'Keefe in training. He's a young conservative activist. And this has brought him into conflict with some of the more liberal faculty members and student groups. And this all came to a head recently when the Chicano and Latino Studies Department had a supplement in the student newspaper, published a poem that Mr. O'Brien was offended by. And so he went to confront the faculty sponsor for this paper. And he brought his video camera. He went to the professor's office. And he walked in through the open door and started asking him questions on camera.
Point of fact, he didn't actually go through the door. He stayed outside the threshold.
I should be clear. So he stayed outside, but he went to the office and started recording this encounter. The professor asked him to leave. He called campus police. Mr. O'Brien talked with another professor there who also asked him to leave, closed her door, and called campus police. This led to disciplinary proceedings against Mr. O'Brien. He had some further run-ins with them after he was told to stay away from the department unless he had a valid reason for being there. And ultimately, he filed a First Amendment lawsuit saying that the school's harassment policy was unconstitutionally overbroad and vague, and also that he was being deliberately retaliated against because of his expression of his opinions.
And the court came to the conclusion, they found that the policy itself wasn't the problem, but this individual had alleged such an extensive, what amounts to a conspiracy against him for essentially being a conservative firebrand, that even if the policy itself was facially valid, he was being treated in ways that reflect the administration's disagreement with his views, and that is a plausible First Amendment claim. Even if, in this case, he could have been removed by campus police and disciplined as a consequence of entering into the faculty members' offices and recording them, if, in fact, he was disciplined not primarily because of this behavior, but because the officials personally didn't like him, and there's a great deal of, at least in the alleged facts, evidence that he was being mistreated as a consequence of his beliefs, that's a First Amendment issue.
And this case, I think, is also a good example of why it's important that courts be careful at the motion to dismiss stage in constitutional litigation. Our listeners may not realize this, but one of the things that happens early on in much constitutional litigation is the government asks the court to throw out the case, and they say, just, you know, you shouldn't even bother to hear this case. There's no way this guy can prove his case. In First Amendment cases, that's particularly dangerous. And what the court is really saying here is we're not saying that he's going to prevail, but he has to be given the chance to prove his claim in court, to collect the evidence that he needs to demonstrate that these people did in fact retaliate against him, not for the videotaping, which the court says he did not have a constitutional right to do in the manner that he did, but for his previous speech on things like Facebook, in which he plausibly alleges he was being retaliated.
Which is constitutionally protected activity. So he posts on a website of his own creation information about a student body president being an undocumented immigrant because of his opposition to illegal immigration. And if the substance of his claim is that he was mistreated in part as a consequence of expressing this belief, which also clashed with the beliefs of the faculty. And in terms of the substantive evidence that he's being retaliated against, sense because of who he is rather than what he did. The disciplinary committee initially recommended that he simply be restricted from being near the Chicano Latino Studies building for an extended period of time. But when it ultimately came down to impose a sentence on him, he was actually suspended for an entire semester. So that suggests that the administration was actually treating him differently than the evidence would bear out, his actual behavior would bear out.
We probably don't have time to get too deep into it here, but I would urge our listeners to take a look at the opinion, also because it provides sort of a harrowing look into campus due process and the way that they look at these claims. You have these charges
brought against you. No attorney, no recording.
That's right. You're told you can have a non-attorney advocate with you, but you can't have an attorney with you. They will make a recording of the proceeding, but you cannot have a copy of the proceeding because that's school property. It's a kind of a topsy-turvy situation that they throw you into. But at least in this case, Mr. O'Brien is going to have a chance to go forward with his federal lawsuit and maybe prove that the school did unconstitutionally retaliate against him.
Evan, let's move now to the Fifth Circuit with kind of a similar case.
Yeah, this case also involves student speech. This is a high school student at a public high school and an aspiring rapper. His name is Taylor Bell. Taylor Bell is a student at Itawamba High School. He is told by several of his friends about alleged sexual misconduct by two coaches of the school sports team. He takes to Facebook and YouTube and posts a rap recording that is profane, vulgar, contains a lot of violent imagery directed at these coaches as a consequence of what he has heard about their sexual misconduct. This comes to the attention of school authorities. It comes to the attention of the coaches in question. This is all off-campus speech, but people at school know about it. And as a consequence of them knowing about it, it ultimately transpires that he is brought before a disciplinary committee and he's suspended for school for several days. And the question is whether this is a violation of his First Amendment rights, insofar as nobody is claiming that he made what would be a constitutionally unprotected true threat against these coaches, or that his speech is otherwise not constitutionally protected. But the claim is that he is speech was sufficiently disruptive to school proceedings that he could properly be disciplined. And the Fifth Circuit actually held that, yes, he could be properly disciplined. This was a material disruption of the school environment, and therefore there was no First Amendment violation.
This case raises some really fascinating issues, and all of this goes back to sort of a problem that the federal courts have been facing for decades of how to deal with First Amendment issues when you have kids who are compelled by law to be in this school environment. If these students were in private schools, there'd be no First Amendment issue here whatsoever. The school can set whatever rules of conduct it wants for off-campus speech. But at least since a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court called Tinker v. Des Moines, which involves students who are wearing black armbands to protest the Vietnam War, there has been this tension where public school officials have tried to figure out, how much sort of dissent and protest are we required to tolerate from students, and how much order can we impose on the school process. It's a real challenge for these schools, and it presents some of the more difficult and interesting First Amendment questions that we see.
Yeah, Tinker is a fascinating case because in that case it involved teenagers who wore Black Panther armbands to school. The court actually held that their First Amendment rights had been violated when they were sent home as a consequence of wearing these armbands, because it said that they hadn't materially and substantially disrupted the school environments. However, in years following Tinker, you have seen a more deferential approach taken by the lower courts to claims that students have disrupted the school environment with respect to what they've done or said. I mean, kids wearing NRA t-shirts, kids wearing Marilyn Manson t-shirts, these have been placed within this scope of substantial disruption.
And what made the court come to the conclusion in this case that the video, the rap video, was disruptive?
Essentially because it was published on Facebook and YouTube with the anticipation that it would reach people at the school and therefore students would react to it, the teachers would come to knowledge of it, and therefore it could have reasonably been expected to disrupt the school environment, even though he wasn't on campus when he made the speech, and even though Tinker itself dealt with on-campus speech and focused on the particularly disruptive nature of in-school expressive activity.
Although, you know, one of the interesting things that's going on here is it shows how technology has kind of changed the calculus of Tinker, because one of the coaches who is mentioned in the rap video learned of this when he saw it on a student's smartphone. So even though the recording and the posting all took place off of campus, because basically every student has a smartphone now, these videos are viewable on campus. And so it raises interesting questions about the extent to which technology can take that off-campus speech and inject it into the campus environment.
Yeah, this is a very complex issue, and there's no easy resolution to it. A couple of the things I find very troubling about the majority's decision is that, one, it relies upon school policy in determining whether something is a substantial disruption for constitutional purposes. So the school's policy is that X, Y, and Z constitute a substantial disruption. The court takes that as evidence that they are aware of the constitutional issues and fits that within the scope of what constitutes a substantial disruption for Tinker purposes so that we don't have a First Amendment violation. I think that that's very problematic. Second of all, the standard and the way in which that they approach the question of whether this student was actually punished as a consequence of concerns that he was going to be violent or that he was going to be disruptive, or whether he was simply punished because people didn't like his speech, because it was filthy, because he could have chosen better words to express himself. The court kind of glosses over this, and you only get a sense of that from the dissent.
So this case actually came down a few months ago, and the reason why we're talking about it now is because the U.S. Supreme Court has recently decided not to take the case up on cert. That's unfortunate because there are multiple dissents in this case. It was an en banc decision, and there are very strong dissents. And the court really hasn't given a lot of clear guidance on how lower federal courts should resolve these issues. So even though this case is not going to the U.S. Supreme Court, it's certainly not the last we're going to hear of this issue, and it's something the court is going to have to take up at some point in the future.
Paul, let's move on to the Tenth Circuit now for a case involving jury nullification.
Yes, so this case is Verlo v. Martinez, and it is a case involving jury nullification, which is the practice of a jury who believes that a person is guilty of the charges that are brought before them, but nonetheless votes to acquit. And there are people out there, groups like the Fully Informed Jury Association, who think it is important that jurors know that they have this power and that they exercise it in certain classes of cases. And they have a habit of leafleting outside of federal courthouses, which has sometimes brought them into conflict with local police or with court officials who don't want them to engage in this kind of speech because they think it's a form of jury tampering. So what happened in this case is the courthouse in Denver had tried to prevent some people from doing that. A couple other people wanted to engage in this speech, and so they filed a federal lawsuit saying, we want to leaflet outside the courthouse. And they ultimately won a preliminary injunction before the district court, which was affirmed by the Tenth Circuit. And I think this case is notable because it is, in my opinion, a real example of judicial engagement and good judicial craftsmanship. This is a situation where it would have been easy for a court to be disengaged and to credit the concerns of the government that there's going to be chaos if people are allowed to leaflet outside the courthouse. And the court really looked at the evidence and said there's no evidence that that's true. And then it entered a very carefully crafted preliminary injunction that will allow these people to speak, but will also not allow them to interfere with people entering and exiting the courthouse. I think the court did a really good job with this case.
So there are often protests outside this particular courthouse that are disruptive. That's not what was happening here. That's not what these pamphleters want to do.
No, there was no claim of specific disruption here. This is just a flat ban on expressive activity outside of the courthouse. The the 10th Circuit of this case draws upon McCullen v. Coakley. This is a Supreme Court case involving a buffer zone that was created outside of hospitals in Massachusetts for sidewalk counselors. These are people who want to talk to women who are going into hospitals, maybe procuring abortions, want to talk to them about abortion. There was a buffer zone created such that they couldn't get within 100 feet of these women, and the Supreme Court said, you cannot create a zone that is this wide that affects people's ability to peacefully come up and talk to people. The same principle is being applied by the court in this case.
This case also raises some interesting, or at least interesting for First Amendment advocates, questions about what's called forum analysis. So your First Amendment rights when you are on government property are not always the same depending on the nature of the government property. There's property that's considered a traditional public forum, like a public park, where your First Amendment rights are at their absolute maximum. And then there's property that's considered a non-public forum, like, say, the inside of the Pentagon, where you have no First Amendment right to be whatsoever. And then there's some areas that are in between, and the court really grapples with what kind of analysis should apply depending on what type of forum this is. And interestingly, the government that was defending these restrictions said it doesn't matter because even if this is a classic public forum where people's First Amendment rights are at their maximum, these protesters should still lose. There's just a lot of if you really want to learn a lot about kind of the First Amendment and modern First Amendment doctrine, you couldn't go far wrong by reading this opinion.
Right. So actually, the government argued below that the restrictions that it had placed on this expressive activity could withstand any forum analysis, even strict scrutiny. Then on appeal, they tried to make the argument that, well, no, we haven't waived the argument that this actually isn't a traditional public forum, and we can contest that on other grounds. And the appellate court basically said, you've waived that argument. You didn't make it in the first instance. You can't continually allow your legal strategy to evolve.
Yeah, and this is something certainly that we at the Institute for Justice have seen in other litigation where the government will essentially say, look, we should just win under the easiest possible theory or, you know, under the most straightforward theory, and we're not even going to bother to put forward any other theories. And then when they lose under that theory, their position evolves and they want to bring forward new arguments or new evidence that they didn't bother to present before. I think it's admirable that the court in this case says, look, you chose a litigation tactic. It didn't work out, and you are stuck with the results of that.
For the non-lawyers, bringing a new theory at the appellate level is a no-go, right?
So what you're allowed to do is you can raise new arguments in defense of kind of claims or defenses you have already made. But if you have waived a claim or a defense, you can't raise it for the first time on appeal. And so that's really what's going on here. Certainly if you brought like a 14th Amendment case and you didn't also raise a First Amendment claim in your argument as a plaintiff, you can't do that for the first time on appeal. So plaintiffs wouldn't get away with that, and defendants shouldn't get away with that either. And that's what the court held in this case.
Okay, Evan, let's move on to the final case, which takes us to the D.C. Circuit.
So this case involves the Davis-Bacon Act. This is a federal law that requires federal construction contractors to be paid prevailing wages when they are working on public works that are publicly contracted for. And the question is whether the Davis-Bacon Act applies to a privately funded, privately operated a group of essentially luxury shops in the middle of the District of Columbia.
Real quick, what are prevailing wages?
They are prevailing union wages. They are higher than wages that these workers would receive had they not been part of unions.
And one of the interesting things about this case is that the District of Columbia did not contract with any of these workers for the construction work, all of that was done by private companies. And yet the remedy in this case, if a Davis-Bacon violation were found, was that the District of Columbia itself would have been liable for up to, I think, $20 million in back wages to these workers.
Yeah. The District of Columbia owns the land, but it has leased the land for, you know, successive periods of 99 years, right? It is operated, and the contracts were made by private developers for the purposes of luxury shops that cannot... I mean, the claim that these constitute public works like the equivalent of a dam or a highway or a road is absolutely ridiculous and implausible. And the fact that the federal government was actually arguing that this constituted a public work was tells you the degree to which the federal government will go to extend its power to boost union wages.
Yeah, Judge Kavanaugh makes very short work of the government's argument on both the public contracting side of it and the public works side of the opinion. One of the things that I think is interesting about this, though, is the case that's not mentioned until the very, very last paragraph of the opinion, which is Chevron.
Yeah. So Chevron holds that agency interpretations of ambiguous federal statutes will be upheld by federal courts if they are reasonable. It is a very deferential standard of review, but it only kicks in once a court has decided that a statute is ambiguous. However, if you engage in context-sensitive analysis that considers not only the text but the purposes of the statute and also the context in which it was drafted and the agency's practice over a period of time, you don't necessarily have ambiguity, and therefore you don't need to defer to the agency's determinations of how a statute should be interpreted. And that's extremely valuable because Chevron has created a status quo under which most of the law under which we live is made by unelected bureaucrats and not by elected representatives. This is the antidote to Chevron: careful, fact-sensitive judicial engagement at the outset with respect to the meaning of the statute.
Yeah, you know, if you read most administrative law decisions, what makes this decision remarkable is virtually all administrative law decisions start off with a big explanation of Chevron and how deferential courts are supposed to be to agency interpretations of law. And then they go through this Chevron analysis, which, you know, we won't bore you with on the podcast. But here it's treated almost as an afterthought. Basically, all Kavanaugh says is, look, this statute's clear. Nobody could possibly believe that Davis-Bacon applies to this situation, and treat Chevron as an afterthought. Frankly, I think we could do with a lot more of that from the federal judiciary.
Louis Vuitton is not a public work.
That's the takeaway from this case.
Okay, that concludes the show. We thank you for listening, and we hope you'll tune in next time for more from the world of judicial engagement. Until then, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, goading you to get engaged.